he did that, because it was a great honor to do that. You know, I learned a lot. Thank God I have a husband who loves the AA program. He's not in it, but he loves to help me out wherever he can. So that was a great service. But I will give you my thank you.
My name is Mike. I'm a recovering alcoholic.
Hi, everybody.
Happy Saturday night. Happy Founders Day. It's Founders Day night. And many congrats to Janie. And she was one of the primary mother hens of our district, and especially getting our picnic together. And you know, the annual picnic is a very fun day that we have in the Mount Vernon district. And you know, you've done a lot of good work there, and it's always an honor to be asked to speak, and I really appreciate you asking me. So I'm glad to be here. My sobriety date is November 26, 1993. My home group is the Keep It Simple group. We meet on Tuesday nights at 7:30, right up the road. And I'm also a member of the Bar None Men's group in Alexandria, Old Town Alexandria, on Saturday mornings at 8:30. I was there this morning, and I told the guy I was speaking tonight, and he said, oh yeah, that reminds me of the guy who was, you know, he was speaking, and, you know, he was 45 minutes into his talk, and he was on step two, and then he was 58 minutes into his talk, and he was on step five, and people sort of were like looking at their watches, and they kind of got up and started to leave, and 2 hours later, he was still talking, and there was one guy in the front row. And he looked down at his watch, and he said, oh my goodness, he said, you know, thanks for hanging in there with me. And the guy said, hanging in there with me? I'm the second speaker. I don't know how long I'll talk, but, you know, I'm supposed to say what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And, you know, Founders Day is a big day in Alcoholics Anonymous, June 10th. It's the date that the second guy, not the first guy, the second guy had his last drink. Dr. Bob had his last drink on June 10th, 1935. And it was started, as many of you know, of one drunk talking to another. You know, Bill Wilson was in Ohio. He, not to give you a big history lesson, but he was about 5 months sober. He had a business trip. Things went south. He went in the bar. He heard the gay chattering of the glasses, and he said, uh-oh, I think I might drink. And so he ran to the phone and started putting nickels in the phone and said, I need to talk to a drunk, and made a series of phone calls. And you know, finally Mrs. Cyberling set it up where he could talk to Dr. Bob Smith. And delightfully grumpy Dr. Bob said, I'll give you 15 minutes, you know, and they talked for 6 hours.
Oh.
And in the little room at the gatehouse. I was there a few years ago. We went out there. My wife's here tonight. My son's here tonight. My sponsor's here tonight. And my sponsee's here tonight. So I got a quad lie detector out there. I really got to watch myself. Anyway. You know, it's one drunk talking to another, and that's how we go. I was going to start by saying two things that happened to me, you know, not 30 years ago, but yesterday. I had a little phone call with an organization known as the Internal Revenue Service yesterday morning, and they had made a mistake. And even though they made the mistake, I had to be very polite and very you know, humble in talking to them, because it's kind of like when I'm driving and I see a flashing light behind my car, even if they're not coming after me, I still, in my mind, I think, uh-oh, they're on to me. So I called the IRS. I was on, my sister said, you're going to be on hold for 45 minutes, which I was. And we got it straightened out. It was relatively, I didn't even call my sponsor about it, but it was relatively painless. But I used to call my sponsor about that kind of thing all the time. But it reminded me when I was newly sober how I was so terrified, and I had so many problems with the IRS, and among others. Actually, the IRS was the least of my problems, but the IRS was one of my problems. And I remember going down to their office downtown near Union Station and just sitting there, like being so scared, you know, newly sober, like, what am I gonna say? What if they arrest me? Are they gonna lead me away in handcuffs? You know, what's gonna happen? And, you know, it just kind of made me chuckle yesterday. And then last night, I played poker. I'm in a poker league. We play every 2 or 3 weeks. And I played spectacularly last night. Spectacularly bad. I bounced down in like 40 minutes. And, you know, but I still put out my cheese and crackers that I always bring. I bring something to the party. It reminded me of when I was newly sober. I used to drink and play poker with a different group of guys than who I play with now.
Right.
And I was going to host a poker game, and I was probably a month or two sober. And I was at, it was going to be on Saturday night, and I was at the Friday night meeting at Belhaven. And I raised my hand, and I said, I'm supposed to host a poker game tomorrow night. And I was like, oh no, am I even supposed to say that? And the old guy who was leading the meeting kind of nodded his head, and he said, well, just talk to some of us after the meeting. And I was like, okay. Uh-huh. And I thought, as soon as he said that, in my mind, I thought, you know, can I run out of the room? Because I thought he was going to come up to me and not only say, you can never play poker again. I took it to the extreme, and I thought he was going to say, you can never have fun again.
Yeah.
Like I was bracing myself for him to say that. And he came up to, I went up to him, and I was like, uh-oh, what am I supposed to, and so he said, well, what do you drink when you play poker? I said, well, you know, I usually drink beer or, you know, vodka, whatever. And he said, vodka tonic? I said, yeah. He said, do you like tonic? I said, yeah. He said, well, that's what I usually drink when I play poker. I usually just drink tonic. It has a little bite to it. And whenever I play now, my son's laughing because I have this huge cup. It holds like more than a liter. And I fill it with fresh ice that I make myself, fresh limes that I cut myself, and fresh tonic that I buy myself. And I put it in there. And like some of the guys, they still don't know what it is who I play with. They're like, what is that? I just like make a joke about it. You know, I keep my anonymity. One of my friends in the program got me in this group. But so, you know, we can have fun. And in fact, next Saturday is fun day. They're having the big party in Arlington. It's a picnic that they have every year. It's called Fun Day. It's a picnic. So if you can't wait till September, till the Mount Vernon picnic, go to the Fun Day picnic. Mm-hmm. And so, let's see. I guess I can give you sort of the LP version tonight. I started drinking when I was really young. I come from two big Irish clans up north. My father's parents were from Ireland, and my mother's family was from New York. And so when I was in New York, they'd be, you know, drinking wine, and the room smelled like really good, like Pinot and Bordeaux wine, and they'd eat dinner at 9:30 at night. So I got that. And then when I was in Massachusetts with my father's family, I remember on July 4th, 1976, they painted their house like an American flag. So we're in the backyard, you know, drinking beer on the 4th of July. So. But I mean, to the Irish, alcohol is like a food group. Mm-hmm. Like I never thought anything bad about alcohol. And you know, sometimes when I heard people about hiding their alcohol, like, why would you hide your alcohol? I never had to hide. I hide my drugs, but that's another story for another night. But I didn't hide my alcohol. And I don't think my parents are alcoholics. My mother died about 4.5 years ago. I don't think my parents are alcoholics. They used to drink whiskey sours. They put it in the blender. They'd have whiskey sours like every night around 5:30 when my father came home. And sometimes I would stick my finger in there and sort of, it was kind of tangy, and I'd taste it. And part of my story is I don't have a brother. I have 4 younger sisters. And I kept sort of waiting for a brother, and I was in a lot of pain about that, although I didn't really realize it till I got sober. And you know, my sponsor's kind of my pain in the bleep, you know, older brother, and my sponsees are like my brothers too. And this program has given me brothers. In fact, my other sponsee who's not here tonight calls me brother, and my wife gets a chuckle out of that. But he calls me up, he says, what's up, brother? And you know, it's funny, but it means a lot to me. So I was sipping on booze from when I was a kid, and we were out of Wisconsin. I was probably 11 years old. We had a family gathering out there, and I was in a bar in like this rural Wisconsin in the summertime, and I sat up in the bar and I said, you know, can I have a tab? And you know, the diet soda. Mm-hmm. And I guess the bartender thought I said tap because he put a draft beer in front of me. And I was like 10 or 11 years old, and I was like, oh, this is kind of funny. And I think I just laughed and maybe took a few sips of it. But I was at my uncle's. I had some crazy uncles in New York, and I was in New York City when I was 11. And we were down in Chinatown and we drank some beer. We could bring in the beer in the restaurant, and it was summertime. We walked back to Brooklyn, and I was sort of giggling. I'd had like a beer or two, and I was giggling, and I had to pee really bad, so I was peeing, and I looked up, and it was this giant building, and it was the World Trade Center. They had just built it. I was like, looking up at this giant building, whoa, you know? And I came to D.C. My mother went to school in Washington, D.C., and so did all my aunts. I grew up in Rhode Island, but my aunts and my grandmother, they went to Trinity. So when my youngest aunt graduated, I was saving my money all year, and I visited her when I was 12. And I came down to D.C., flew down by myself, and everything was kind of going wrong on this trip. We were supposed to go to Ford Theater. Things got canceled, this and that. We were running around town. So somehow it was like this kind of weather. It was like nice, sunny day. We were in the backyard of their Georgetown townhouse, and I got into a drinking contest with a bunch of 22-year-olds. And I'm not sure if I won or I lost, but the next thing I knew, I was like drunk out of my mind. And we were driving around town, and I was in Lafayette Park, and I was peeing in Lafayette Park. Oh. I'll try that today. And, you know, I was looking over, and I saw two white houses, and that was funny. And, you know, everything was funny. We got back to the house, and, you know, there was this girl there, and I guess I was like groping her or whatever, and she was like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "I don't know." And you know, and then, I was like 12 years old, and so I woke up with my head in the toilet the next day.
Yeah.
And I told my aunt, I said, "I'll never drink again." It was 1973. I was 12 years old, and I took my last drink in 93. And I promise I won't go through year by year, but I do have a couple of more stories about my young drinking. And the next one is I started drinking to my eighth grade dances, and I would pilfer a little bit of my father's booze. I cleaned out a mayonnaise jar, washed it out myself, cleaned out a mayonnaise jar and put in vodka, rum, whiskey, mixed them all together. Yeah, pretty much. And then I hid them in the woods, and then before the dance, I was like holding my nose and like sipping them, and I was getting like the shiver and the little, you know, and then I went to the dance and I was like, oh yeah, and I was like banging my head against the brick wall and everyone was laughing and I was like, oh yeah, this is good, and you know, I was, you know, a white guy can dance, you know, and this and that, but what was going on was my friends had moved away and I didn't have any really one to talk to. I didn't have a brother, I didn't really have a friend, and I liked this girl. I had no idea of how to do that, like how to like the girl. And somehow she became my girlfriend. And I didn't even know what that was. I was 13. And then one day she called me up, and then she wasn't my girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea. I had no one to talk to. I had no idea what to do. It was summertime. I went in my closet. I turned the light off. I couldn't even cry. I was just like a stone. And I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And, what I did was, within a few days, when my father was out, I picked up a bottle of room temperature gin, and I started, like, guzzling it like a fountain into my mouth. And if my father didn't come home, you'd be listening to someone else right now, because I would have been dead. Mm-hmm. I almost died. I had some rage issues against my father. My son knows I love my dad today, but at that point, you know, I was full of rage, even though I was just 13. I picked up a knife, and I thought I was going to stab him, but I didn't stab him. I just ran, and I was a good runner, and I ran like 2 miles. And I saw myself falling over in the gas station window. In fact, I showed my son where I did that last year. We recreated it. And I fell over onto my chin. I still have a scar. I call it my gin scar. And I woke up in the hospital, and my parents were on either side of me, and they were they said that both of my grandfathers had died from alcoholism, and I didn't know that. One was 67, and one was 55. Or 51. I'm 56 now, and my mother's father, and so I was just in the hospital. And I was kind of shaking my head, and I was just thinking, I will never drink gin again, and I couldn't. Even when I smelled gin, when I was drinking, you know, for 20 years after that, gin would make me puke. So, you know, God forbid I drink again, it's not going to be gin. So, you know, but even when I bartended, I had to keep gin away from me. And, you know, so sometimes I think, well, what would have happened if Alcoholics Anonymous was in the hospital when I woke up? and but they weren't, and you know, I had to follow my own path. And I wanted to tell one more story about that period. About a year later, I was probably 15. I didn't even have a license. You know, I was too young to drive, and my parents were out, and I was drinking whiskey. And my mother had a 63 Volkswagen Beetle, Hortense, with a sunroof. And I took it out. I didn't know how to drive a stick. But, you know, after, like, drinking, you know, half of a fifth of whiskey at 15, I thought I did. So I was, like, trying to find the party. I was like, where's the party? I'm driving. And I drove into Cranston, Rhode Island, which is a really blue-collar, Italian, tough town, and crashed into somebody's fence, and then backed up and crashed into their truck. And they kind of came out, and they were like, well, what are you doing? And I was thinking, you know, I still think to this day, if I had ran over one of their beautiful daughters, one of their beautiful Italian daughters, you would definitely be hearing someone else. Right. They would have killed me on the spot. Uh-huh. And, you know, so these are sort of some of the death-defying things that happened when I was a kid. And they let me go. And I somehow drove home, and I wrote my parents a note. And I signed it, the idiot, me. You know, you know, but drinking sort of took off in it. You know, I really liked basketball when I was a kid. And I was pretty good for a while, for a minute, when I was 12 or 13. And then I couldn't stick to it. I couldn't, like, do the work and the practice that was required to be really good, you know. And it wasn't a Michael Jordan situation where I got cut from my team and made it the next year, you know. I got cut from the team and I didn't go back, but I started running instead. I was running. And I was looking at my yearbook a couple of years ago, and a lot of the signatures in my freshman high school yearbook were like, to a good runner and a great drinker, you know, that's what they said, you know, so it was like already the writing was on the wall. And but I didn't, you know, I thought I knew how to handle the drinking and handle it under control. So for years after that, I was drinking and traveling and went to school and sort of had it under control, but always drank. It was always like I said, a food group, and you know, I would work. And finally, I came to Washington. I came to D.C. 30 years ago. I came here in '86, and I got out of school. And I had breakfast with my brother-in-law the other day. He was in town, and he was like, "Well, why did you come to D.C.? Why did you like D.C.?" And I was like, "Well, you know, my aunt went to school here, and you know, this and that." Well, I was walking around in D.C. Last night after on my way home from the poker game. I stopped by my office and I walked through some of the alleys downtown, and I didn't tell him, but I'll tell you, I really love the alleys in D.C. I used to spend a lot of time in the alleys, and just, you know, I would, you know, water finds its own level. And you know, and I was walking through the alleys last night, and I was kind of chuckling. One of them was like right behind the bar I used to drink it, so I was sort of chuckling. And but you know, I found the alleys, and D.C. was a great drinking town. I met a girl who's my son's mother, my lovely ex-wife, and she was fun. And you know, then when she got pregnant and I had a role in that, the funny thing happened. She stopped drinking immediately. She stopped drinking and everything, and mine just like took off. And you know, again, I really didn't have anyone to talk to. I had a next door neighbor, but I was just kind of lost. But on Friday nights, I would always I used to play darts then, and I used to get out of work and I'd go down to the bars around 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, have a few beers, warm up with the darts, and then go to my bar, you know, maybe smoke something in the alley, and then just come back and play darts. And I was good from about like 3 to 8 or 9 beers. But after that, you know, I would be like, I'd kind of go off the cliff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, things got kind of crazy because of me. And, you know, before my son was here tonight, took off. My older son's not here tonight. She took off with my older son on Father's Day, and I tore the whole house apart. I was like crazy and insane. And then she finally came back, and then we had our other son, thank God. And you know, but I was still like, you know, I wasn't a great husband, and maybe I was an okay father. I think I might have been, but you know, I was just kind of out of it, and I was disconnecting from reality, even though I was working. And you know, the short version of the story is we got into it, and you know, the cops came out to the house, and this was down in behind Groveton, and they, you know, I was going to tell them what happened, and they put the cuffs on me and took me out of the house, and you know, they took me down to the precinct right over here in Mount Vernon District, and you know, and I had these old pajamas on, and you know, they had me in the cell. There was a bunch of drunks screaming in the cell. I wasn't really drunk, so I was like, what's going on? And then, like, at 4 in the morning, they chained me to the bad boys, and they left the drunks in the tank, and I couldn't have my glasses. I didn't know where. I thought I was going to Lorton. I didn't know where I was going. And I was scared. And my pajamas were, like, trying to fall off. And they took me to Fairfax County Jail. And so I was in the Fairfax County Jail, and I was in the cell. And sorry, I should turn my phone off. It's probably my sponsor. And yeah, my other one. So I was in the cell, and I'm sitting in this cell, and I'm like, how did I get here? Like, a minute ago, I was 12 years old. Like, what am I doing in this cell? You know, what the hell happened? And then I was sort of thinking about, you know, I'm Irish. I was thinking about Bobby Sands, like, starving himself to death. I'm like, I'm going to starve myself to death. I'm a political prisoner. And, you know, that's how my mind was thinking. And so you know, the kind of funny part is I went into court the next morning, and you know, I was handcuffed, and I had the old pajamas on, and my pajamas fell off in the court. And the judge was like, "Well, someone cover that man up," and I'm just standing there shaking my head, and you know. And my sponsor's here tonight, and sometimes, you know, when I carry on, he's like, "Don't you remember where your drinking left off? You were hanging out in court, you know." And literally, I was hanging out in court. And yeah, but, you know, the odd part of the story is I didn't say, when my friend came to pick me up, I didn't say, "Rush me to Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "Rush me to 7-Eleven. I need a beer, like, so bad, you wouldn't believe." And I went home, and I thought, you know, I could apologize, and it's okay, honey, and we can cook out. And she was giving him boxes of my stuff and said, you know, he's like, "Dude, you got a restraining order. You're not going home." So I slept on his couch, and you know, that night, he had a dog. His dog's name was Cruiser, Border Collie, and the dog slept on my lap, on my belly. And I was just like, I started, like, crying. And I cried every night for the next 20 months. I drank for 6 more months, and for the first 14 months of my sobriety. And those tears were, like, wonderful and what I needed. I mean, later, when I was sober a year or two, I read in a magazine that tears take toxins out of your body. I was really toxic. Yeah. I had to get a lot of toxins out of my body. And, you know, long story short, my roommate at the time, who I thought might be here tonight, but he's not, but he had a book that he wasn't using. It was called 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. So I was sort of peeking at that. And then somehow I got a hold of the book called Living Sober, the old yellow version. And I really like the yellow version, the classic version. So I read that. The boys went out to Washington State for Thanksgiving, and I was in their house. And even though I have the long version tonight, I can't really explain how I didn't drink for 3 weeks in early November, but somehow I didn't drink, and there was some, I had a blind date in that time, and I met a gal from New York, and she had 3 years in the program, and it blew my mind. And she said, "You know, you can treat AA like a movie," and she made it seem like less threatening to me. So she kind of put a bug in my ear, so I hadn't drank for 3 weeks. I had one glass of wine that weekend when I read Living Sober, and I was really struck by the attitude of Living Sober that said, "It's up to you, you know, like, whatever you want to do is fine, you know, we're not telling you not to drink, and we wish you well, whatever you do." And I was really, really, that appealed to me. So I drank half a glass of wine, I went out with a whimper, not a bang, And I went to a meeting. My roommate said there was a meeting at Wellington on Monday night. It was a full moon, like it is tonight. And I went to the meeting, and they said, "Is there anyone new?" And I said, "I'm Mike." And, "Hi, Mike." And I was like, "Oh my God," you know. And I didn't say I was an alcoholic. And then they did the closed meeting statement. I didn't really understand it, but when they were saying, you know, this is a closed meeting, like I almost got up and walked out. And, you know, but then it said, if you think you have a problem with alcoholism. So there's no accident the way the language is crafted in here. And speaking of language, this guy came up to me after the meeting, and I knew him. I knew him from the Men's Anger Control Program of Fairfax County. And so he whispered in my ear, he said, "The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking." And that blew me away, and I was like, wow, you know? And so I came back, and this was November, and I came back, and I had a date with my ex-wife on New Year's Eve, and you know, she knew I was trying to get sober, and she's one of these people that can keep a bottle of vodka or wine in her house for like a month or two and not drink it. It's crazy. And so we didn't drink. You know, I was like, "Well, let's pop the champagne." She's like, "No, we don't need it. We don't need champagne." So somehow I didn't drink, although I thought I was going. And then I met my sponsor. One night, the old timers used to talk about gratitude and staying away from the first drink. And they were saying one night, everyone was saying, "I'm one drink away from being drunk," and I raised my hand and I blurted out, "I'm one drink away from death." I like blurted it out. And my sponsor kind of turned around and was looking at me. I don't know if he remembers, but I do. And he gave me his card that night, and he said, "You know, call me anytime, even if it's like 2 in the morning. Well, 2 in the morning, I called him. And, you know, and I called him I called him a lot. And, you know, he really helped me and he saved me. And, you know, it's funny, you know, because I sponsor another guy. You know, I'm friends with him now. And I sponsored him for like a year or two, and I finally met his wife, and when I met his wife, he said, "Oh, honey, this is Mike, you know, he saved my life," and I was kind of like, I was a little uncomfortable that he said that, and she kind of came over, and she looked at him, and she looked at me, and she looked back at him, and she said, "I think in your case, honey, it takes a village," and so that was, you know, even though my sponsor really did help me a lot, like, I had nowhere to go, man. I was just pounding the crap out of meetings. Back in the cold winter of 93, 94, like it was ice, there were ice storms, and I was walking to the meetings, I would walk to the meetings and just go to the meetings, and, you know, I had no other place to go, and, you know, and I had trips, I went to New York, and I was in Florida for a week when I had 3 months, and I went to a meeting after the, at the end of the week. I was in Florida for a week on business. I spent $27 of my own money for a taxi to go to a meeting. That's a lot of money for me. I had no money. And I spent $27 to go to this meeting. And I was sitting next to this big biker dude, this big burly biker dude. And he said, "I just threw away a year and a half of sobriety last night." And I was so used to being the new guy. And like at the end of that meeting, they didn't come up to me. They came up to him. And I was like, "Oh, okay. Yeah, that's what's going on here, you know? That's how we help the new guy." So that was like a wake-up call. And I went to my sister got married. That was crazy. And then I went to France on a business trip. I was 9 months sober. And I'd been to France before. I went to school in England for a year, so I'd been there. My sponsor grew up in France, so but this was before, you know, the internet in 94, and so I couldn't really talk to him. And I was in, we were in Paris. We went to the oldest restaurant in Paris. It was with a few Americans and our French host. And this guy liked to drink, and he liked to party, he liked to have a good time. There was this beautiful French woman who was with the party, like right next to me. She was smoking cigarettes and being all elegant. And I was like, "Oh my God," you know. And the restaurant smelled like my grandmother's living room with the wine. It had the exact same smell. And I was like, "Shh." And so the guy's like, I was like fighting off the wine. And he's like, "What? No wine?" And I said, "No, no, no." And he said, "Not even a little?" And I said, "No, no, 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 no." We were going to Bordeaux the next day for 4 days, and he smiled at me right across the table, and he said,
Bordeaux is going to be tough.
And I swear to God, I said to him, I don't need to worry about Bordeaux tonight. Because you guys had already told me in 9 months that it was one day. Like, all I had to do was get back to that hotel that night. My sponsor told me, get back to the pillow and don't drink. And man, I was just like, oh. But you know what? He was right. Bordeaux was really tough. And one morning I overslept and I was like so dry. I hadn't had coffee. I took a cab to the hotel, the conference center, and there was no coffee, there was no water, there was no juice. They had a tray going around of pea-colored morning wine. And that's all they had to drink. And I was freaking out. And I was like, I ran to the men's room. I got down on my knees and I said, please help me, God, please. And I came out, I guess my face was like turning colors and stuff. And this British waitress saw me. And she's like, are you okay? I'm like, no, there's nothing to drink. I can't drink the wine. And she got me a big pitcher of water and kind of looked out for me for the next few days. Mm. And so that was like the first experience that I had of my higher power sort of, you know, helping me out. And, you know, I didn't want to come back to my home group and my day group with these funny black ladies in D.C. that I used to see every day. I didn't want to come back and tell them I drank. I kept thinking about them. I was like, I do not want to tell them that I drank. And, well, I don't want to drink because I don't have to tell them. So somehow I got back to Paris, and I remember I called my sponsor from Paris, and I was like, oh my God, I got through it, I didn't drink. And now I'm going to Barcelona on the night train. Mm-hmm. And so I did that too, and I didn't drink there either. And there was a full moon there too. And it was actually my birthday. It was my belly birthday when I was in Bordeaux. And we went to a party that night, and we went into this room, and there was a champagne fountain, and I was just staring at the champagne fountain. And the girl I was with kind of nudged me and said, they're playing your song. And I was like, what, what? And they were playing Happy Birthday, but not for me. It was like the organization's birthday. So they were playing Happy Birthday, and I didn't even notice it. I was just staring at the champagne. So, I can't explain it. So, sometimes I say that my story is I'm telling the real short version of my story, like in one sentence. My story is a cross between the biblical story of the prodigal son and the Eagles' hit song "Desperado." that's kind of my story. And the prodigal son. I mean, I'm not going to give a religious seminar on it, but I did. I went on a retreat when I was newly sober, and the prodigal son is the son who goes off and he drinks and he carries on. And he comes back broke, and his father sees him and hugs him and loves him. And it's like the coolest story in the Bible for me. And I went on this retreat. It was a silent retreat. Thank God I didn't have to talk because I was new, so I was probably like 9 or 6 months sober. I think I was in my first year. So the priest was reading the story of the prodigal son. It wasn't even an AA retreat. I don't know how I got on it. Of course I was crying and I was like, oh my God, And then the priest said, the prodigal son is not about the prodigal son. It's about the father. And that just blew me away. And, now I'm a father, and, one of my sons is here tonight. And, I stopped on my way home tonight, besides going into the alleys last night, I stopped at the National Cathedral on my way home. Full moon, love it up there. They have a statue of the prodigal son in the garden. I couldn't find it. I was like, did they move it? So I was looking around for it. I think there was a guard in there, and I was like running away from the guard. I was like looking for it. And finally, I found it. I took a picture of it. And, the father's like holding the son like this, and it said, there's a little plaque, and it says he saw him coming from a long way off, and he hugged him and loved him. And, those dark nights in my first year of sobriety, like that's how I got to know my higher power, because there was no way I was going to, quote unquote, have a relationship. Like I was talking to my ex-wife, and I was relatively new, and I said, hey, it's funny, I get hugs from the guys, and I get hugs from the older women, but I don't get hugs from the younger women. She said, well, that's just because they don't know you yet. And I was like, okay. And then she said, then they'll really stay away from you. she had a good sense of humor, too. And but I did have a relationship, and when I was about 2 years sober, and it was a spectacular crash and burn in Palo Alto, California on a Thursday night. She broke up with me. I didn't drink. And but it was it threw me for a loop. And there's some funny stuff that I won't go into, but involving a yellow highlighter and some other stuff. But naughty thoughts and highlighted in my journal. But when I got back, I was like, you know, I was between 2 and 3 years sober, and I was sort of in pain, and I was like going to meetings like crazy, and I was at the DuPont Circle Club on a Friday night, and this guy was drinking while he was leading the meeting on a Friday night. He had a paper, he had a coffee cup, and he had booze in the coffee cup. And some of the people were like sort of grumbling and this and that, and I'm sitting there, and I'm like, this is great. I'm like, I'm going to throw a butterfly net over this guy after the meeting. He's going to be my first sponsee. And, I tackled him after the meeting, and I said, let's go. I took him to Starbucks, you know, put a big butterfly net over him. And he was my first sponsee because I was like Bill. I was desperate, man. I was like, you know, and I don't know what happened to that guy. I've sponsored quite a few guys over the years, and I'm in touch with a lot of them. They really are like my brothers. Usually when they move away, they get new sponsors. So I don't know what happened to this guy, but, you know, I remember going to see the movie Swingers with him. We literally fell off our chairs. We were laughing so hard. Like when the guy calls the girl like 5 times at 2 in the morning, we were falling off our chairs laughing so hard. And, you know, so that was great. And, you know, we talk about, you know, having fun in here. And, you know, I talked about the basketball, how the basketball had gotten away. I coach basketball. I coached my son's teams for 10 years, 5 1 year, 5 one son, 5 the other. And I was pretty psycho, but we had fun. And one time I yelled the S word, like I yelled it in the gym, and you know, and my girlfriend at the time said, well, at least you didn't yell the F word. And but I, you know, the basketball had gotten away from me, but the other thing I really wanted to do was play volleyball. And I went to an AA picnic, and I was a few years sober, and they were playing volleyball. So I started playing, and I was having a great time. It was pretty good. I love volleyball. And it prompted me to join a league. And I played volleyball for like 3 or 4 years. I was playing like every season, indoor, outdoor. I would go to pickup games down in the mall. I went to California. It's right around when Princess Diana died, I remember. And I was out there by myself on a trip. And I went down to Huntington Beach, and I sat there for like 2 or 3 hours, like waiting to play a doubles game of volleyball. And they've been playing all day, and they were like starting to pack it up at the end, and they were like, I was like, where are you going? I've been waiting all day to play. What are you doing? So I like made them play another game with me. They crushed me. I got crushed, but at least I played volleyball on the beach in California, you know? And you know, so that was great. And I will say this about my father. Like I said, I had a big resentment against him, and you know, I love my father dearly now. He's 80. He was born the same year as AA. He's 81. He's going to be 82 this year. Still plays golf. We play golf with him, and he wanted me to go to this like sort of quasi-religious type church retreat, one day thing. Lou Holtz was there. I really didn't want to go. I did not want to go to this thing, and I went. I went to this thing, and that was how I did my 9-step with my father, by going to this thing. And after that thing, whatever it was, I really don't to this day know exactly what happened. We told each other we loved each other, and that was like we had never done that before. And you know, I did do a 9-step with my ex-wife in 2002. That was after another breakup. Been through a few of those, and. I will say this about the closest I came to drinking was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And since my sponsor's here, he knows the story inside and out. Boy, does he ever. And, you know, he had told me in June of 2007, 10 years ago this month, like, not to do this thing that I really wanted to do. And it was pretty dishonest and this and that. And he basically told me not to do it. And I did it. And boy, did I pay a price for that. Like, I paid a huge price for that. And a couple months later, on August 20th, day 5015, that was a fun day. And, you know, as I like to say, I got the adult version of the phone call when that girl had called me when I was a kid, and very adult. And the cells in my body were screaming for alcohol. Like, I wanted to drink so bad. And I had been in a restaurant that night, and I didn't have a drink in front of me. I was in my apartment in D.C., but I wanted to run back to the restaurant and drink. And I called my sponsor, and I'll just say this for sponsorship, and my sponsee's here too, and Mark calls me just about every day. You know, when I called my sponsor that night, I knew him for 13 years, I didn't have to call him and say, "Hey, Brian, it's Mike. Remember we met 13 years ago in that meeting and you gave me your number? Here, let me fill you in on what's been happening in the last 13 years. And by the way, I'm about to drink." No, he already knew me inside and out from years of talking, communicating, going through the steps, fifth step, inside and out. So, you know, I couldn't have done this by myself, you know, and I can't even imagine. You know, sometimes when I meet people and my dear mother, I think my mother sort of knew, but if she would say, you know, "You're strong," or "I'm so proud of you," it's like, yeah, I am dedicated to stay sober, and it's the most important thing in my life. And I don't go around proclaiming it on the street, but I couldn't do it myself, you know. I go into the jail sometimes and bring the meetings in there. I brought a guy in the other night, and he was leading the meeting, and he did a great job, and he was telling the inmates, you know, when he used to come out of jail after he'd been sobered up, he'd think, "I got this, you know, I'm going to do this now." And you know, we were both sort of laughing because that kind of attitude, you're in big trouble. Like, I can't do this myself. And that was the whole thing about, you know, how Bill and Bob came together and started this. So, you know, I'm really, really grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. And you know, I was telling my son before the meeting, you know, I don't talk shop with him much, but, you know, we hear a lot of stories in here about people going out. And, you know, I've had people from my home group who have gone out, and they've told me to my face, one guy told me in sessions a few years ago, "Mike, it doesn't pick off where you left off. It's worse." Like, I've had people tell that to me in my face. And, like, having that kind of face-to-face interaction is like 1,000 meetings in 1 second. And so I don't kid around with that, and you know, I still, you know, like my wife tells me, I'm self-centered all the time. She's sitting back there, so I have to be, you know, I constantly have to be on guard about that. And she always says, "It's you." Like if I get riled up in traffic, she'll say, it's you, you know. So it's like, you know, I have to remember that. That's kind of what you guys teach me too. So thank you for letting me share.